Hello, and welcome to the 9th episode of Let's Talk Iran, providing Iranian-American perspectives on current events and policies that shape U.S.-Iran relations and affect the Iranian-American community. This program is brought to you by the National Iranian-American Council, otherwise known as NIAC. I'm Nobar Elmi, and I'll be your host. I'm here today with Eric Ferrari, an expert on trade sanctions law. In addition to his law practice, Eric also writes extensively on sanctions on Iran, both through his blog, www.sanctionlaw.com, and his book, Iranian Transactions Regulations Practice Guide. Eric, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Starting off kind of at a very basic level, can you just tell us what are sanctions and how are they enforced?
Okay, well, a sanction is a prohibition on a category of activities in relation to a targeted nation, a targeted individual, or a targeted entity. In layman's terms, what does that mean? That means if somebody has been targeted for sanctions as a U.S. person, you cannot have any business dealings with them, you cannot have any financial transactions with them, you cannot provide any services, etc.
Okay, so how do the sanctions affect the Iranian-American community? Like, what are the typical situations, if there are any, that most Iranian-Americans find themselves when it comes to dealing with sanctions and the laws that are being imposed on them?
Sure. Most of what we see is related to family-type relationships and transactions that may arise out of those relationships. For example, the passing of a relative in Iran and somebody receiving a portion of inheritance from that family member. Let's say that they obtain an interest in a home. That happens quite frequently. Well, they can't just sell that interest in their home, or they can't just sell that property because of the sanctions, so they're required to get a license. Other issues generally relate to receiving money from or sending money to Iran, taking care of maybe a divorce in Iran and having to hire a lawyer. All of these types of transactions are impacted by the sanctions and in many cases are prohibited without a license from the Department of Treasury.
There's talk of havala transfers being treated differently than, let's say, bank-to-bank transfers. Is this true? And also, can you just give a definition of what exactly are these havala transfers?
Sure. I think you break down financial transfers into three categories when you're talking about Iran and Iran sanctions. You talk about direct bank-to-bank transfers. Well, obviously, there is no direct bank-to-bank transfers anymore because of the sanctions. Then you talk about the transfer of funds through a sadafi or a money exchanger who actually takes the money and moves it through a foreign financial institution and then onto your U.S. bank account. And then you have havale, or as they call it in the West, hawala. And those transactions are different because they do not utilize any type of banking system. Essentially, the way it works is you have two brokers, one in Iran, one in the United States. Somebody will go to the broker in Iran and say, I want to send X amount of dollars to Mr. So-and-so in the United States. The hawala broker in Iran will receive the money along with an additional fee, and then he will call his counterpart in the United States, and he will say, please give X amount of dollars to Mr. So-and-so in the U.S. In that scenario, these two brokers keep a running tab of who owes who what, but they don't actually transfer the money through any foreign financial institution, so there's no record of it. Havale is strictly prohibited under the sanctions regulations, and in many cases under different federal statutes as well. So you have to be very careful about using havale.
Okay, so it sounds like a lot of these sanctions target imports, but do they cover exports as well?
Oh, absolutely. There's generally four categories of prohibited transactions under the trade ban, which is the most commonly enforced sanctions program against Iran. And those four prohibitions or categories of prohibitions deal with imports of Iranian origin goods or services, exports of U.S. origin goods, services, or technology, and that also extends to the re-exportation, meaning the export to one country with the knowledge that it'll go on to Iran, and then trade transactions anywhere in the world for Iranian origin goods or services, and facilitation of transactions between foreign persons who are if that transaction would have been prohibited had the U.S. person been directly involved. So export is definitely in that set of prohibitions and one of the bigger ones.
Now, how carefully are these actions being monitored? Are they really cracking down? For example, if I go to Iran and I want to bring back a bag of pistachios, or if I want to bring back a gift from my grandmother, do I really have to be concerned? Or, I mean, how to what degree are they enforcing these rules?
Well, you talk about enforcement in a couple of different lights. They are enforcing the law pretty heavily. And let me throw out some numbers at you. In 2009, there were 1,000 OFAC, that's the government agency that regulates and administers the sanctions. There was 1,000 OFAC investigations. Of that, about 66% or 665 were related to Iran. So they're initiating roughly two investigations a day almost for Iran-related stuff. Now, this question comes up a lot. You know, people kind of scoff at the idea that they could get in trouble for violating the sanctions if they bring back a bag of pistachios. Are you going to go to jail for bringing back a bag of pistachios? No, probably not. But may you go through some headaches? Yeah, sure. Particularly because OFAC leans so heavily on both other federal agencies and the private sector to enforce the sanctions, you get a lot of people who aren't maybe experts in the regulations having to enforce the law. Let me give you an example. You're bringing in jewelry or a small bit of cash or even pistachios into the United States, and a customs agent at Dulles Airport catches you and asks you, you know, where did you come from? I came from Iran, and, you know, I brought these things with me. The next thing you know, he seizes those items from you. He may send off a report to OFAC saying, you know, we believe that this was an importation of Iranian origin goods, even if it was only for your own personal consumption or your personal use. So in the long run, no, you won't. You probably will not go to jail for that. Almost definitely will not go to jail for that. But you're going to have to deal with a seizure by customs, potentially a seizure by customs, and a possible federal investigation. And you just really want to avoid that if you can.
What are the best ways for people to stay informed or get information on what they need to do, you know, if they do want to kind of engage in any kind of transaction with family members, for example, back home?
Sure. Well, I wouldn't call them the newest round. These prohibitions have actually been on the books since 1995. It's just people are starting to hear about them now because they're more heavily enforced than ever. So what would they do? There is a variety of resources on the internet. If you go to www.treas.gov/OFAC, that's OFAC's website. They have a lot of information on there that they can provide you. There's a frequently asked questions section that has a lot of answers to common questions. Obviously, myself and other private attorneys write blogs that have some useful information. Organizations like NIAC have put out information as well. So you can get a general idea. The thing that's important to remember here is every case is different and every set of facts is looked at differently. So if you're really concerned and you're not sure, you should definitely, at a minimum, call a private attorney and get their take on it. You may even want to try to call the OFAC compliance hotline and just ask some questions. But if you do that, be very careful what you tell them because you might actually self-disclose a violation in doing so and cause more trouble for yourself.
You know, Congress is continuously looking for ways to impose tougher and harder sanctions on Iran. And one of the newest proposals is to sanction the Iranian Central Bank. Has this ever been done before with any other country, for example? And what would this mean for the Iranian American community?
Yeah, I mean, there's been the sanctioning of central banks before. Certainly Libya's central bank was just designated earlier this year as part of the round of Libya sanctions. It's pretty devastating, and let me explain why I think it's more devastating in Iran's case. The rial is controlled essentially by the central bank, so almost every transaction that occurs in rials or at some point has rials involved in it could potentially, or the central bank could potentially have an interest in that transaction. So in the event they're blocked, any transaction in which a blocked party has an interest becomes blocked itself. Okay, so let's say you have a transaction in rials for the sale of a house, and you receive rials in Iran, and gets transferred into, you know, I don't know, Indian rupees, and then you want to send it on to the U.S. Well, originally they were in reals. So at one point when it comes out of that financial system, and if it ever touches a U.S. financial system or a foreign intermediary bank, which has nexus to the United States, under a wide interpretation of the blocking regulations and the blocking statutes, then technically they may have an opportunity to block that transaction, even though it's being converted out of reals and into some other form of currency. A lot of this depends upon how aggressive they want to be in enforcing this. Some people have called this the nuclear option in sanctions. You would essentially be taking Iran's currency out of the marketplace completely by doing that, given the central bank's role in regulating and controlling that currency. Even if Congress passes this law, it's still going to fall upon the agencies to regulate it and to enforce it. And I'm not entirely sure how aggressive the executive branch will be in enforcing those prohibitions and blockings in that case. They could be very aggressive, and we could have this scenario like I just described, or they could be more lax and just look at those transactions in which central bank is directly involved, not just reals. So anyways, that's a long way to get to your second question, which was, how does this impact Iranian Americans? Well, certainly, it's a lot different to have a transaction blocked versus rejected. So currently, if you, as an Iranian American, sell a home in Iran and you don't have a license, then and you try to transfer the money to the United States, the proper thing for the bank to do is to actually reject the money, meaning they just send it back to the originator. Okay, well, that's kind of a hassle. If it's a blocked entity involved in the transaction, for example, if central bank becomes blocked and they do take this aggressive approach on the real, then the U.S. bank would not properly reject the transaction. Rather, they would actually block or freeze the transaction.
And so would you lose your money then?
Is that what you wouldn't saying? Lose it permanently, but you would lose it for as long as the central bank was on the sanctions list, on the specially designated nationals and blocked persons list, which I should also say central bank is on that list now, but they're not listed as under a blocking program. The Iranian transactions regulations is a trade ban, but it's not a blocking program. So really, it's only on there because it's identified as part of the government of Iran. But right now, they're not under a blocking program. So the transaction is properly rejected at this point.
Okay, so it seems like there's a lot that is left to interpretation.
Tons, yeah.
And I guess it's just a lot of watching to see what Congress will do next, right?
Yeah, it is. And not only Congress, but, you know, you have to look at the executive and really how Treasury and State are going to take the approach on this sort of thing. I think that if they thought it was a good idea, they would have done it some time ago. Obviously, I'm not in Treasury, or I'm not in State, or I'm not close enough to know what the feeling inside the executive branch is in regards to designating the central bank. From what I hear, they're not that excited about it. So it'll be interesting to see even if Congress does pass some sort of legislation which calls for the blocking of central bank, how the executive goes about enforcing it and how aggressive and strict their interpretation is.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but thank you so much for providing us with your insight on this very interesting issue.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
For more information on Eric, visit www.ferrari-legal.com. And as always, be sure to visit NIAC online at www.niacouncil.org.